You're listening to the Just One Outdoors Podcast.
As many of you know, I use Fit to Hunt to prepare for my elk trip. Being fit to hunt is about more than just peak physical fitness and looking good in your camo. It's about having the tools and capabilities needed to achieve your goals. Those goals that take you all over the country, exploring the wilderness and everything nature has to offer. Fit to Hunt offers DIY workouts, personal training, and even some custom workouts. What I used was the DIY workouts. Their DIY workouts range from everything from duck hunting, to turkey hunting, to backcountry hunting, to just basic conditioning with their base conditioning program. You can get most of the DIY workouts for under 20 bucks. Go to stayfittohunt.com or follow the link in our bios to learn more.
Alrighty guys, welcome back to the podcast. Today we've got an awesome guest and I don't want to botch the introduction. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about yourself. Austin and I are huge fans, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are as well, but please go ahead and introduce yourself.
I'm Bill Thompson. I'm a founder here at Spartan Forge and, been doing this for about 2 years and, I don't know what else to say really, retired from the military after 21 or so years of service. And started doing Spartan Forge as a hobby in 2015, and then as an actual business incorporated in 2017. And we've had an app on the App Store for 2 years. So that's the long and the short of it.
So I guess I've heard the timeline a little bit in the past, but you were in the military. You mentioned starting this as a hobby. What were you doing when you were in the military? Did you get back? Were you doing something else? What was that timeline?
Yeah, I was in the military at the time. I joined the military. I signed on the line in November of 2000 and retired from the military on Halloween of 2021 and started kind of the hobby or pulling the string on the possibility of being able to train a neural network to predict deer movement in like 2014 or 2015, somewhere in there, and had the first, what I would call successful trained neural network sometime in like 2017, 2016, maybe. I'm going to get my dates mixed up, but somewhere in there. And then after that, I, you know, incorporated the LLC and went out looking for people to kind of bring into the company. And I hope I answered the question there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really interesting that you've taken what you did in the military. You can probably share a little bit more on that because we've listened to you. We know who you are. We kind of have your background, but some of our listeners may not. But you've taken that and kind of turned it into something that a lot of deer hunters use. And I found myself using it this year to pattern pretty much one deer and use the app and like the prediction stuff, all of that, to know, hey, this is probably my ideal time to hunt this deer. So going off that, can you share a little bit what you did for the military, in your time when you served?
Yeah, sure. So I was that's an oxymoron for military guys, or at least that's the running joke. I did intelligence work for basically the entire time. I started doing like electronic intelligence and like the precursor to like what people call cyber or like on-net operations, and did signals intelligence. Also had like did I was also a linguist. So I did that as an enlisted guy, which who haven't served, it doesn't make a lot of sense to them, but there's basically like three flavors of soldiers. There's the enlisted guys that are kind of, you could think of it like a schoolhouse. The enlisted guys are basically like your students, but they're also the ones that do all the work. And then you have your officer cohort, which are your teachers and your administrators. And then you have your warrant officers, which are kind of like the people who determine the curriculum and maybe do the training surrounding that curriculum to the teachers. So that's kind of the way to understand the military, if I could use that analogy, which doesn't quite meet muster, but I think it relays the point. I was an enlisted guy first. That's to say, I was kind of like doing the actual job of intel collection, both in signals intelligence and as a linguist, and later in human intelligence. And then after that, I became a warrant officer, which is, you know, like I said, that, you know, the people who kind of determine curriculum and do the technical training for the teachers or for the NCOs, the non-commissioned officers. And I did that for, geez, I'm losing my timelines now, for about the last 12 or 13 years. And most of my time as a warrant officer was in what the Army calls a special missions unit, which basically just means you have the right skills for a job and we don't want you moving all around the Army. So we're just going to keep you in this one spot doing this one thing. That's the probably the easiest, quickest way to say it. And I supported special forces and special operations for the majority of the latter part of my career.
Gotcha.
Where were you stationed doing that?
All over the place. Germany, two places in Germany, Colorado, two places in Colorado, Hawaii, Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina, back to Maryland, then retired from Virginia and deployed to Iraq multiple times, Afghanistan multiple times, to Africa multiple times, the Philippines, which a lot of people don't even know that we were kind of supporting combat operations in the southern Philippines, but I did that. Same with northern and the Horn of Africa. And let's see, where else? Other places I'm just not remembering off the top of my head. Well, I spent some time in Eastern Europe, Moldova, and the only real place I didn't really do any operations would have been South America. Otherwise, if you know, most of Western Europe, a lot of Africa, all of the Middle East. My first language was Russian, and my second language was French. So a lot of that as well.
That's impressive.
It's really impressive.
But before we get into Spartan Forge a little bit, what age did you join the military, and what was your thought process getting into the military?
I was 17 when I joined the military, when I went through what's called MEPS, which is the military entry processing system. Are either of you in the military? Cause I don't want to talk to you guys about stuff that you already know, if you've already been through the military, or I suppose I should anyway for your listeners, but I just, you know, sometimes I'll be talking to a military guy for an hour and he's like, So I'm just trying to make sure I'm, you know, keeping everyone can listen and understand what I'm talking about, basically. So yeah, I signed on the line when I was 17. My only frame of reference at that point is I'd grown up in rural North Dakota, and I knew I wasn't going to be a farmer. I knew I didn't want to be a farm hand, and I knew I didn't want to be a banker that supported farmers. I knew I didn't want to be a waiter who supported farmers. That was really only my job choices. I could have been a mechanic who supported farmers. None of those things where I was from interested me. And all I was trying to do at that point was remove myself from North Dakota. Not that I don't love it. I love North Dakota, and I'm going to be heading there towards the end of the month to go see family. But it wasn't at that point in my life. It wasn't the time for me. It kind of set me on this journey that is, you know, I can tie a string to, you know, where I am today precisely because of it.
Gotcha. So as we kind of get into the Spartan Forge side of this, I think, you know, a lot of people have heard you on other podcasts or, you know, with Seek One and stuff, and kind of have heard how you built the podcast, but I'm curious, like, at least in a brief way, could you describe what the app and Spartan Forge is? And then I'd like to get into more of kind of practical uses and like how I know that your predictions are working for my area and different things like that.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, most of my interest, at least when I started the organization, when I started Spartan Forge, was in machine learning and artificial intelligence, which really, you know, I've been on calls all day, and this is only one I was looking forward to, but the other ones I was doing was like different types of marketing calls. And, you know, I take a lot of input from people that we're now paying to kind of do the market analysis and to understand things. And the way I was relating it to them was kind of, because I was answering the same question for them, is it's really just a machine recognizing patterns instead of a human recognizing patterns. If we say artificial intelligence, but there's a lot of things that get mashed into the term intelligence. And I think that we've kind of painted it with really broad strokes, and it's really not intelligence in the traditional sense of the word intelligence, in that you can sit and you can think up and have a thought that you've never had before as a human. Like, we can just sit by ourselves, and whether we're praying or we're meditating or we're thinking, something can occur to you. Nothing can occur to a machine that it hasn't been told. So they're really not intelligent. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, as a Christian, I might say the source of that is God. Or agnostic person, or even an atheist, you might say it's transcendent spirituality or transcendent consciousness, whatever it is. Machines don't have any of that. So a lot of people are like, oh, in the next 10 to 20 years, we're going to have AI systems. I think it's like 70 years or 80 years. I don't think we're anywhere near. Elon Musk has been trying to get cars to drive themselves for 10 years. And he's, you know, that's just one facet of the human experience that we're pretty good at. Not saying machines won't be better. It's just all of the effort and time and machine and energy that goes into that is far more than what it takes for a human to do the same task. So artificial intelligence is just that. It's pattern recognition. It's understanding patterns that exist in nature, and then you're stating a beginning and an endpoint, and you're telling the machine to arrive at the same endpoint that you would, or that a rational person would arrive at. And instead of doing it, we really don't know how we do it. And scientists don't really know how we do it, which is another interesting way to say, how can you say that a machine will achieve consciousness in the next 10 years when we don't even know what consciousness is? Like, scientists don't have a good idea for what consciousness is. They can't tell you what it is or where it exists in the brain even. But we have it. And so, that, you know, AI recognizes those patterns, and it happens to do really well, and it can function really quickly in, you know, neat little boxes where you give it rules and you tell it to do things. And so that's kind of what I started doing with Spartan Forge, was after doing some of this type of work in the military, just kind of realizing that there were a lot of parallels for hunters, and that it's a machine learning company. And that's where I wanted to start. And I was actually going to partner with other organizations that were in the mapping realm, because I knew whatever the output of the intel of the neural networks was going to be, was going to have to interact with a map in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. So I knew I needed mapping, but I needed other things as well. So my plan was actually to partner with some organizations that were already doing this, but just through a mixture of things, I wasn't able to arrive at a deal with these guys that I thought was, you know, good for all parties involved. So mm-hmm. I decided that building a map really isn't the difficult part. And I think we've really gotten to the point where our map's as good as anybody else's. And we did it in about 18 months. And these jokers have been working on it for like 10 years. And so now we're just getting to the point where we've got most of what the other guys have. We're missing some stuff on the data side when it comes to like property ownership. Like, we're at like 90 or 91% mm-hmm. of the U.S., whereas, you know, some of these other guys might be at 95 or 96% of the U.S. So we've got a delta that we have to make up there. But as far as the function, the reliability, the interplay, the user experience, the user interaction, we're on par with these other guys. So that was kind of the first big decision I had to make as the CEO of the organization, was I going to continue looking for a mapping partner, or should I just build the dang thing on my own? And I just decided to build it on my own.
Yeah, it's been fun to watch. I've used it for, I think, the past couple seasons, maybe three seasons. And I would have a couple apps just because, like, in some of the areas we hunt, the public land wasn't as defined. Yeah. It was kind of just like a square, and it was like, well, that doesn't show me my boundary, right, especially in an urban area. And yeah, now I got on this year when, you know, I started doing some scouting and stuff, and all those are now defined, and it's very precise, and, you know, it's right on par with every other app that me or friends of mine might be using. So it's been cool watching that transition and the growth.
Yeah. And now we've just gotten to the point in the last 2 months here where we can start putting out stuff that's actually, you know, a market discriminator, where, you know, I had a balance I had to strike as well, where I'm kind of standing on a seesaw where I need to have as much feature, or at least a minimal amount of features, that the other apps had, so that people didn't have to depend on everyone else to kind of get them where they're going, but then have this crappy map of ours in the background. But I also had to be putting out features at the same time that incentivized people to pay for the product. So mm-hmm. we've just gotten to the point where we've got most of the features, and we have to polish some stuff up, and we will do that in the off season, like with tracking and a couple of other things that we know, and the data on ownership, that we know we've got to iron a couple of things out there. But now we're starting to put out, and you guys are going to see here over the next few months, we're going to be putting out stuff that people have never even thought about associated with the hunting community. And so I'm really excited about that. And it's taken us, you know, a while to get here, but we're here now, and it's just, you know, patience, I guess, was the key, but we're here.
Buzzard Roost saddles made right here in the great state of Louisiana should be on every Louisiana bow hunter's list as a must-have in their hunting arsenal. Buzzard Roost Saddles achieves comfort through adjustability for those long day sets during the rut, and also provides the maneuverability to get up and move when you see the need. Buzzard Roost Saddles was created with the need to lighten the piro as well as the backpack to go deeper than everyone else. Louisiana bow hunters are a mixed bag, and Buzzard Roost Saddles is the tool to fit any job. Whether it's public land, private land, hardwoods, pines, or even the bottomless swamps, Buzzard Roost Saddles has what you need to stay mobile.
Tell us everything.
But you maybe generally you can tell us, and hopefully this doesn't put you in a tight spot. But like you mentioned, there are a lot of competing apps out there doing a lot of similar things. And, you know, there are certain features between apps that are similar, and there are certain features that are different. What are some things maybe now that you guys offer that are unique and different?
I'd say one would be like our LiDAR layer. Some, you know, people will point out online like, oh, this app or so-and-so gives out like a LiDAR layer, but it's not nearly as high res for most of the US as ours is. We've stitched ours together much better and done the mercatoring or the mapping, the grafting of the map over other maps more accurately. The stitching on our app was done much better, but it's also done within the context of hunting, which these other ones that are out there, the other LiDAR layers that you can find in other places, are not done in the context of hunting. And you can also flip between an aerial map and other ones and stay in the context of whatever hunt you're focusing on while you're using our application, which is not something that you can do with other ones. But then it's also centrally located. You're not spending your time searching for LiDAR and loading it into your application and going through all of the rigmarole that you have with these other ones. So that was kind of one of the major first ones. You know, now some of the other ones have kind of caught suit with us, and they did like the slope angle stuff that we had been doing earlier mm-hmm. on. None of them have really been able to crack the 5 centimeter, 15 centimeter imagery, which we have for about half the US. Another one that no one else will probably have for a while, just because the sheer amount of work that it's taken to put into it, is we'll have about 7 to 10 years of historical imagery here on the market the next month or two for all of the US, not just part of the US. And that'll be at 1 meter. So you couple that with the LiDAR, with the slope angle, with the, I think, superior way that we use 3D mapping, and we emphasize that. And then some of the cool 3D mapping visualizations that we'll be coming out with here pretty soon, and kind of dynamically presenting these mapping layers in a way that, again, people probably haven't thought to think about or haven't considered is a way that they would want to interact with the map. We're going to be doing some of that stuff. On the AI side, we're going to be coming out with some stuff that I think is, you know, has, if I do it correctly and if we market it correctly and it's received correctly, has the ability to really disrupt the market. As cliche as that term sounds, it's the proper word. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in the interim, that's those are the things here that are happening in the next months, but then also some other stuff on the maps and other things that I've talked about in the past that again, fit under that rubric of AI that I think are really going to, kind of push technological capacity and let people know that we're a serious actor in this space. If they haven't thought that to themselves already, I also see that we're trying, like, I even talked to my wife about this the other night. I monitor and do a lot of the customer interaction on my own, or almost all of the customer interaction on my own. And that's important to me as a CEO, but then also, I spend an inordinate amount of time monitoring, Facebook groups about hunting and that type of stuff. And I would say this year, Spartan Forge has really started to enter the zeitgeist or the spirit of the time as it concerns, when people talk about like what mobile hunting apps they use or how are they using it or what is superior. You know, you'll see us, it's basically, you know, for the majority of them, I would say it's, you know, the question is what's the superior hunting app. I would say almost 1/3 to a half of people are saying, you know, in the last 3 or 4 months, it's been Spartan Forge for me. We're going to continue to do that. And we've got stuff teed up to really, you know, step on the gas pedal and create even more of a disparity between us and the competitors who really have been largely dealing in commodity data, I would say, until they saw us come on the market. And I think some of them have tried to do things. Some of it has fallen flat, but they really were relying on the market to just be this stale thing where they could just keep uploading layers and market new layers or the new, you know, they spent way more money on marketing than they were on technology and development. And way more money on trying to present an image of who they think they are, who they think their market wants them to be, while acting quite oppositely in the opposite behind the scenes. And I also see that kind of falling apart for some of these companies too. So I'm excited about, you know, I've been very excited and very happy with the past 2 years. And we have had the app on the store for, this was our third season, but the first one was a beta. The first season was a beta, and that really was just to get the AI out there, our production application without the beta tag on the app itself. We're in the second season now, and I only see the quality and the offering of the product to vastly increase over the next 2 years.
Right on. Yeah, I've noticed, like, with Spartan Forge compared to others, you definitely have, I think one of the coolest things is just all the features. It seems like every time I get on Instagram, like at least once a month, there's something new that's been added or updated. And that's been really cool to watch, especially we're in Southwest Missouri where some of the coverage hasn't been as good, you know, and it's been cool watching that growth. But that brings me to kind of one of my questions that I've always had. And that is kind of for the deer movement and like the predictions and stuff. I kind of know some of the background on how that's done, but like if I'm hunting in Florida, deer movement is obviously going to be different than it is in, let's say, Montana or even Missouri. How does that, like, how do I know that I'm getting accurate data for my area? And how does that process work?
Yeah, so it's fortuitous that you asked about Missouri. I mean, we have collared GPS data for Missouri, and we have collared GPS data for Florida. And we have collared GPS data for, you know, North and South Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Maine, Rhode Island. I think I said Ohio already, but if I didn't, I'll say it again. Minnesota, North Dakota, Montana, Southern Manitoba, Texas, Alabama, I guess those are the major states. But the neural network, as it's trained with this data, favors the movement patterns that are derived from the areas that are proximate to where the GPS study took place. So in other words, to make this way simpler than it is, but to also try to paint an accurate picture of what I'm saying in 30 seconds. If I have a GPS collared deer study from Missouri and I have a GPS collared deer study from Florida, and say in Missouri, and this isn't the case, this is a hypothetical example, say in Missouri, humidity really gets deer moving and it doesn't in Florida. Say humidity almost has no effect on the deer in Florida, but it has a ton of effect on deer in Missouri. I actually think it's the opposite. Let's just stick with this example. The neural network will look at that over time, and as humidity is in flux in either location, it will affect the predictions of the area where it is correlated with movement in the past in that location. So as there's flux in humidity in Missouri, if the deer move more because of humidity in that area, it's going to affect the prediction in that area more than it would in Florida. And so everywhere that we take data from, we separate the collar GPS data into two bins. The first bin is data that we're going to use to educate our model, which is about roughly 80% of the collar GPS data that we ingest. And then another 20% of it stays separate and never sees the model. And that's what we use to test it.
Okay.
So how you can think about that is basically we gauge how well the neural network is predicting on this by using known data that has values and attributes assigned to it by the collared GPS study. So that we're always able to test whatever the output of the app is. And then as we get new data, we separate it in the same way. But then we also have a couple of states where we have live data, access to data that's always being populated all the time. One of the states is Pennsylvania. So I can look at the data in the beginning of the week and see what my network is predicting the movement will be over the week. And then I can wait for the week to expire. And then I can actually look and see what the movement was. And then as that data gets uploaded, it is prioritized to affect the prediction for that area more than it is for other areas. And what will happen is if there's a common thread that initiates deer movement between multiple places, then the network will use it. But if there's not a common thread, then the network won't use it. And more often than not, it's actually the change in environmental factors versus the static numbers in the environmental factors that change it. And that's confusing, I know, because I'm hearing myself talk. But basically, the temperature dip in North Dakota that it might take to get deer movement going might not be, or is probably much more severe than the temperature dip in movement that it takes to get deer moving in Pennsylvania or South Carolina. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so again, the network learns that and uses that and puts it into the model. But we only bin the data six ways. So there's only so many predictions that you can get. And that's because that's what the network shows us is the acceptable left and right kind of criteria for deer movement. Like there will never be a model. There isn't a model. Like if you look at our competitors, and I'm only mentioning them because I think it's appropriate for the discussion. They'll say peak movement in your area tomorrow is going to be between 7 and 8 PM. That is as farcical as, I mean, I'll look at 200 deer in Pennsylvania and none of them start moving at the same time. Mm-hmm. And none of them are moving for the same amount for the same time. And none of them have the, you know, it's not like the deer will get a memo and just say, all right, we're going to stand up tomorrow at 7 PM and start moving around. That just doesn't, that's not the case. It's not how it happens. It's not how it works. So we bin it as according to how the movement, you know, occurs.
So you're kind of relying on collared deer and deer studies. I've got sort of two questions here. First one is, do all of those studies define active or movement or deer moving the same way? Like, is it based on a length of time or a distance traveled?
So how it bins the data and how it looks at the data is a complicated process that we could do a whole, not complicated. It's a difficult process to understand. I will say a simplified version of it, but it's not this simple. Basically what the network will do is, and so are you guys seeing me on this screen? Did I just surround the screen right now?
Yep.
Did I just do that? Okay, good. I want to make sure that I'm not like wider than it is or something like that. But basically, if you have a deer, let's just use a deer. And it daylight hours, you'll see points maybe on this part of the map where it's just like this, like movement throughout the day is just like this. And then around like 4 p.m., you'll see this for the movement. And then at like 6 or 7 p.m., you're seeing dots again. And then at 7 or 8 p.m., you'll see movement to another area and then singular dots again. What you'll see on the map is basically a cluster of dots, a cluster. And are your users or your listeners going to see this? Because I'm really going to confuse them if they're not.
Yeah, they will.
Okay, so on a video. Okay, most yeah. I don't. Some podcasts, even though they all put videos out there, they're like, yeah, but 95% of our guys only listen. So I don't want to confuse people that are only listening. So what you'll get is you'll get clusters of date of you'll get like 1, 2, 3 clusters of movement. Okay, and then you'll get points of movement in between each one of those clusters. The machine knows during the daylight hours that these clusters up here was betting movement, and then this cluster down here might be feeding movement if it's during the evening, along with bedding, because deer will bed and feed around. They will go to a field and they'll eat, they'll bed, and then they'll go to another area and they might stage, and then they'll eat and bed, and then they'll return back to bedding. The machine knows during daylight hours when the bedding is clustered that is their core area. In other words, that is an area where they feel safe. They're not encountering predators. They're not being molested during daylight hours. They're in their bedding area. And then it's relatively immaterial to the machine how much time or how many points pass between there and then the nighttime feeding and bedding areas. So from a pattern analysis standpoint, you've got cluster, movement, cluster. So what the machine does is it looks at the environmental factors that took place during the day, and it takes note of them. And then if you see deer moving a lot more during the day, maybe they're leaving that area more, or they're creating a larger bedding area, or they're moving more often during the daytime hours. Maybe, you know, I think, and I might get this wrong, but I'm pretty confident in this. I think a buck will change its bedding between 5 and 7 times in the first 6 or 7 hours of daylight. Wow. In other words, it'll get up, sit down, get up, sit down, get up, sit down, poop, maybe eat, just in its little area. Maybe one day he does that 18 times or 19 times. The machine will look at that, and then the machine will note the weather. It will note what the changes were from an environmental standpoint, wind direction, variable wind adjustment, direction that the wind is coming from, velocity of the wind, the temperature, the change in temperature, what the normal temperature was, what the temperature was every day leading up to that, which is far more important for deer movement than just one day of temperature. It's not saying, you know, you'll hear people say there's a cold front this weekend, so there's gonna be a lot of movement. And then you'll invariably see on Monday either one of two outputs. There was a ton of movement that day, or there was none, and that's weird. Well, what's more important is, was it warm or was it just, you know, relatively cool leading up to that front? Because that's gonna make or break the decision matrix for that deer on that day that they decided to move just because there was a front. If that was the 15th front that year, it's not going to make a lot of difference to that deer at that point or incentivize movement. Whereas if it's the first one of the year, they'll generally sit them out. But then on the second or third one of the year, then you'll start seeing movement. And that's something only that a machine can grasp. So I got it back to that point, though. You'll have these three clusters of that movement. The machine will measure that and look over time. And then it looks at what's common across the set of deer, not just a deer. And then it will draw out those, it will abstract out those common things that seem to make that bedding situation more dynamic during the day. Or it'll, you know, where the deer are just abandoning that situation altogether. And, you know, you might see them in a field at 1 p.m. when you're driving home from work. the machine really takes note of those types of things. Then it does pattern analysis and it weights its neurons and it makes predictions based on that when those situations present themselves in the future. I hope I didn't just confuse everybody.
I followed. The hand gestures help too.
Absolutely.
We've all heard the saying, a picture tells a thousand words, and the same can be said for deer mounts. A skull on the wall represents so much more than just a successful hunt. It represents the culmination of lots of work, some luck, and rich memories with friends and family. At Just One, we like to hang our skulls with skull hangers from Kibosh Outdoors. The hangers are secure, super easy to set up, and made in the U.S. They even have hangers for as little as $9 to get your skull sitting proudly at the perfect angle. Go check them out at KiboshOutdoors.com or follow the link in our bios and use code JUSTONE at checkout to save 10% on your order.
So out of those factors, say deer moving between those sort of groups that you're talking about how many variables is the computer looking at between those two points to say, okay, this is why they're moving at this time?
Yeah, so depending on the area, because some weather... as a point of contact in Mississippi, relative humidity and the flux of it relative humidity seems to have a large impact on the amount of deer movement throughout the day. Whereas there's almost no impact on that in Pennsylvania. So we actually just don't look at it in Pennsylvania until we find compelling reasons to train the network and give it that humidity data. We're not going to enter it into the matrix because it can only confuse or throw things off. It's not going to add any value to the data if there's no correlation with movement. So that's why I'm saying it's not a static number. It's somewhere between 22 and 30 variables of weather inform the movement prediction. And then that's done over time. So it's not only that day, it's what every one of those little things did for like 30 days before.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. We hope you guys enjoyed it, and we'll have part two available the day after Christmas. We hope that you guys have a Merry Christmas and enjoy time with your family and friends.